Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
This is the fourth recap and rebuttals episode for season one of Solving JFK, covering episodes 20 through 26. Today I'll be joined by Solving JFK producer, engineer, and music supervisor, Jerry DePizzo. Jerry's been working with me on this podcast since the very beginning. He edits and puts all the episodes together, so he's very well-versed in the topic. And in addition to being the producer for this show, Jerry is a member of multi-platinum rock band OAR. You can catch Jerry and the band this summer on tour with the Goo Goo Dolls. In today's episode, we'll be recapping and making conclusions from episodes 20 through 26. We'll look at the firing tests of the expert marksman, Oswald's skills as a shooter, and the allegation that the shots were fired in close succession in Dealey Plaza. Then, we'll turn to the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit and ask whether Lee Harvey Oswald did it, as the Warren Report says. Finally, we'll review the arrest, detention, and murder of Lee Harvey Oswald and try to decipher Jack Ruby's motive to kill Oswald.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. First of all, thanks for all your time and effort in working with me on this podcast and bringing it to life. I can't believe we've completed 26 full production episodes. I remember when we first started this, it's crazy to think. Jerry makes the podcast sound clean and crisp, and he also writes most of the music. The music side of things goes well with Jerry's day job, which is playing saxophone and guitar with OAR. So as far as the music this season, I've gotten a lot of emails and feedback asking, you know, where we get our music from and what the process is like. How have you liked writing music in 15-second snippets, and how does that compare to what you usually do?
Well, thanks for having me, Matt, on this side of the microphone. Appreciate it. 26 episodes. It's a big number, labor of love, but kudos to you, too, for what you've put into it. We've worked a lot on this together, but it's a drop in the bucket of what you've put in on your own, and that's to be commended. It's actually a lot of fun doing the music on this podcast. We put a lot of time and effort into the podcast, but we put them out on a weekly timeline, which means we only have a finite amount of time, and we have a very real deadline all the time as well. So it's very much a stream of consciousness experience making music for the podcast. So it's a lot of fun. There's not a lot of time to put a ton of thought into any one specific idea. So it's actually a really fun exercise to kind of go with, really, some of the times the first gut instinct to whatever I'm hearing, and just try to refine that to a point that I can create something cool and fun out of it.
Well, you do a very nice job of it, and I think a lot of people are noticing, and I always do. Whenever I get the you know, the final draft before we go live with it, I'm just always, you know, my mind's blown by what you do with the music. So appreciate it, man. So as far as the assassination of President Kennedy, did you have any preconceptions coming into the show? I mean, you know, did you lean one way or the other, or, you know, what was your relationship to that historical event?
My relationship to that event is one, just taught the basic things, that an understanding of it was the basic things that we were taught in school, which was JFK was shot in Dealey Plaza by Lee Harvey Oswald. He was shot three times, and here we are. You know, it's certainly intriguing and interesting to dive way deeper than I ever thought we'd be able to go on this topic.
And then, so now that you've been through these 26 episodes, pretty much all of the substance of season one, do you have, you know, what's your perspective now, would you say?
I think there's a lot more to the story, and I think there's a lot more layers than what I think everybody's understanding is probably surface level. We'll say that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, well, we've got a lot to cover, so let's go ahead and get into it. I'm going to go through each of these issues, give the Warren Report side, give the Warren Report critic side. I'll explain where I land. I'll talk about rebuttals, and then we'll get Jerry's perspective and any thoughts he has on these two as we go along. You can also go to solvingjfkpodcast.com. If you want an in-depth discussion, go back and listen to the actual episodes 20 through 26. This is just a high-level overview with conclusions. All right, so starting with episode 19, the first question is it likely that anyone could have made the shots that the Warren Report says were all fired by Oswald under the same conditions that Oswald was alleged to have made them? So the Warren Report says that the shots were fired in 4.8 to in excess of 7 seconds, and there were 3 shots in that time frame. So we have an established window of when the shots must be made by these future sharpshooters who would try to replicate what the Warren Report says Oswald did. We have two different subpoints to look at here: the timing of the shots, and whether the Warren Commission's master riflemen were able to recreate what the Warren Report says Oswald did. So, did the witnesses say that the timing of the shots was in close succession? The Warren Report says that most witnesses believe that the second and third shots were bunched together. But the devil's in the details. It's not a big deal if the shots that were bunched together were far enough apart for someone to load the rifle with the next bullet using the bolt action. But it's a problem for the Warren Report if any of those bullets were fired so close together that the bolt action couldn't have been operated that fast, which is about 1.7 seconds in between shots. In total, there are 44 witnesses who said there was a gap between the first shot and the second shot. Many of those witnesses said that the last two shots came in rapid succession with a pattern of bang, bang, bang. So whether this matters or it's irrelevant depends on how close together those last two shots are. If they're closer than 1.7 seconds or almost simultaneous, as some witnesses said, then it's not even possible that a bolt-action rifle could have fired all of the shots. If, however, when people say bang, 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 they're talking about a 1.7 second period between the last two bangs, then it is possible. The next issue is, do the master rifleman test prove that it was possible to make those shots? The FBI hired master riflemen who were experts, all of whom could qualify for the Olympics. There were 3 of them. All 3 of the master riflemen hit 2 of 3 targets in the allocated time. 1 of the 3 hit all of the targets. But these tests didn't exactly replicate what Oswald was alleged to have done. The Warren Report says Oswald fired 3 shots from 60 feet up at a vehicle that was moving away from him. But the master rifleman fired at a stationary target from an elevation of only 30 feet. The lack of movement and a 50% decrease in the amount of incline would have made it materially more difficult for Oswald than it was for the master rifleman. Also, the clock didn't start running for the master riflemen until after they fired their first shot. So they were able to set up and aim and make sure they were ready. Oswald didn't have that luxury with a moving target. There was a defective scope on the rifle that the Warren Report acknowledged, but the Warren Report says that the defect in the scope actually would help Oswald because of the slope of the road. Now, I don't know about that. It seems like a defective scope that doesn't work the way it's supposed to work would be harder to use unless the person knew how it was defective to be able to account for that, which probably means they would have to have a lot of practice to account for that defect in the gun to make it actually be a pro like the Warren Report says it is. So here's where rebuttal number one comes in. And it's from none other than author James DiEugenio. Mr. DiEugenio says that not only do the Warren Report master rifleman tests show that Oswald could not have done it in time, there was also a test that was done by CBS in 1967. And CBS used 11 different expert riflemen who had ample practice firing immediately before the test, so they all got to practice. And the 11 men tried a total of 37 different times to hit the shots that Oswald hit in the same period of time. They hit 2 out of 3 shots, only 3 of 37 times. So you've got 11 experts, 37 tries. They do what they're supposed to do in 3 of 37 times. Okay, so that is true. And, you know, DiEugenio's point makes it look even less plausible that Oswald could have made those shots in that time frame. My conclusion on whether it was possible for one person to make those shots is that it's a little inconclusive, but it does lean conspiracy. The master riflemen, who were some of the best sharpshooters in the world, did not do the same thing that the Warren Report says Oswald did. And, you know, even CBS couldn't do it with 11 expert shooters. So assuming that those last two shots were not within 1.7 seconds of each other, it may be possible that an expert shooter could have made the shots in the same way Oswald is accused by the Warren Report. It might be possible. But the Master Rifleman test and the CBS test, which used shooters who were indisputably better than Oswald, didn't prove that. Jerry, I've always thought when I talk to people about this case, you know, a lot of people talk to me about going to the 6th floor museum in Dallas, there in Dealey Plaza, and looking out the window and thinking about how easy of a shot that would have been for Oswald to make, you know, and I think it would be very easy to fire one stationary shot and hit a target. It is not that far. But the whole question is, would it be, you know, how easy or how possible would it be with a bolt action rifle? You got to do 1.7 seconds, the car's moving and you got to aim. That's really the question.
I think he's a way better shot than me. That's for sure. I would say it's possible that he would be able to acquire the weapon. It's possible that he'd be able to acquire the ammunition. It's possible that he'd be able to bring it in and stash it at the Texas School Book Depository. And although extremely challenging, it's also possible that he could have made those shots. I would say it's possible, though unlikely.
Yep, that's where I land. So the next question is, is it likely that Oswald himself could have made the shots based on what we know about Oswald as a shooter? So what do we know? Well, we have rifle tests that were scored with a range of 190 to 250. So it's crazy when there's a range, it starts at 190. It's so confusing. But anyway, so that means 191 is 1 point higher than the lowest possible score. Okay. In 1956, Oswald scored a 212 on his rifle test. It's pretty good. But then in 1959, he scored a 191. So 1 point above the lowest possible score, which Lieutenant Colonel Allison Folsom told the Warren Commission was a low marksmanship rating that indicated Oswald was a rather poor shot. Oswald's colleagues in the military, Nelson Delgado, Sherman Cooley, James Parsons, and Robert Block, also all said that Oswald was a poor shooter based on their observations. Now, according to the Warren Report, Oswald didn't have any known rifle practice whatsoever in the days and times leading up to the assassination. There were Oswald sightings at rifle ranges, but the Warren Report says that those individuals who were thought to be Oswald couldn't have been Oswald because he was at Ruth Payne's house with Marina and his children, or he was somewhere else during those times. Also, remember that Oswald had no Carcano ammunition on him, and there was also no Carcano ammo found at Ruth Payne's house or at his rooming house. So the big question is, you know, were the three bullets that the Warren Report says he used and the one live round that was still in the gun the only bullets that Oswald had for that rifle? Usually if you're someone that's got a firearm, you're going to have some evidence of having ammo for that, but perhaps not. Maybe he was just thought he would need only those four. To me, the conclusion on is it likely that Oswald himself could have made the shots? I think this fact tends to lean conspiracy because we have two Marine rifle tests, and the rifle test himself, you know, he did a 191. That was the last one he did. So did he become a much worse shooter? I don't know how you can explain that discrepancy. You know, perhaps he was fed up with the Marines and getting ready to leave or something, but it does seem strange that his score would decrease by so much. But you got the statements of his other fellow Marines. You don't have anybody coming forward to say Oswald was an incredible shooter. Whenever people talk about Oswald being a great shooter, they talk about the time he scored 212, which that's true. That's a better score. But for me, the whole thing is, the reason I rate this as leaning conspiracy is there's no evidence whatsoever that he had any practice coming up on that. So he's supposed to be using a defective scope, which the Warren Report admits was defective, but he's got no practice with it. It's a bolt action rifle. It's got to make all these little movements. He's not like, perhaps he was, you could argue that he was dry practicing at his house, the bolt action movements. I suppose that's possible, but there's nothing anywhere in the record of him having any practice with the months leading up to the assassination. So that's kind of where I land on that.
Yeah, I think there's just enough evidence of him being involved and able to make the shots to keep him in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just enough.
That's kind of what the whole case comes down to, is there's so much evidence against Oswald that you kind of, until you have your overall theory of the case sketched out and you're able to offer like concrete alternatives for things, you kind of have to leave open the possibility that the official story is right until you get everything settled, until you can counter every point. I'm not saying that that's what you have to believe or should believe. I'm just saying certainly a plausible answer just based on all the crazy stuff that would have to happen. But, you know, then again, a lot of the crazy stuff does end up looking true. All right, moving on to the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. So it took about four episodes on this. This is a big one. The third question, did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Officer J.D. Tippit? So this question has multiple subparts. The first one is, what does the witness identification of Oswald say? Does it prove that he's the one who shot Officer Tippit? I've got to say the eyewitness testimony is bad for Oswald. There's six witnesses who identified Oswald at the police lineup. Three identified him from photographs, and two said that the man looked like Oswald, but they couldn't be sure if it was him. But the police lineups were unfairly stacked against Oswald, no doubt. He was the only one with a black eye. He had to say his name and where he worked at a time when everyone knew the president had been shot, probably from the school book depository. So even though nine people did identify Oswald, their recollections of what he looked like varied. They had different descriptions of his jacket and his hair color, and whether or not his skin complexion was ruddy or red. The key witnesses who did not initially identify Oswald are Domingo Benavides, who was so close to the shooting that he was pretty much hiding most of the time when he would have been able to identify the guy, and Warren Reynolds, who was shot in the head after saying he couldn't identify the man and then changed his mind and told the Warren Commission that he could identify Oswald, and then later said the reason he changed his mind was because he wanted to live. That one's a doozy. And then we also, when it comes to Warren Reynolds, remember we have the shenanigans around Daryl Garner being the suspected shooter and him having an alibi from Betty McDonald, who's a dancer at Jack Ruby's club, who then committed suicide while she was in jail shortly after Warren Reynolds was shot. you know, maybe the Daryl Garner, Betty McDonald angle is nothing, but it's just one of those crazy things that I think is worth noting. There were witnesses who said there were two men involved who ran in opposite directions. That's Aquila Clemens, who said there was a heavier man who did the shooting and then went the same direction that everyone says Oswald went. But she also saw another taller, skinnier man in light khakis and a white shirt who she says communicated with the shooter to get out of there, and then he ran the opposite direction that the shooter ran. Frank Wright, another witness, echoes what Aquila Clemens says. No one who identified Oswald as the shooter said that he was wearing a brown shirt under the jacket. I've always thought that that was an interesting fact. So to the extent that they commented, they said that he had a white shirt under his jacket. But Oswald was found with a brown shirt. Also, three people said that the man had a ruddy skin complexion, like someone who has red hair would have. So these are small details, and you could certainly say that if he's wearing a jacket, the jacket would cover up the brown shirt, and maybe they could just see the white undershirt. But I just thought, you know, nine witnesses, nobody mentioned the brown shirt that he was found wearing. My conclusion on the witness IDs is that it does lean towards the Warren report. While the police lineup certainly was unfair and would be thrown out in a criminal trial, I don't think we can ignore what nine witnesses did, and that was identifying Oswald. Now, while I would not vote guilty in a criminal trial due to those issues with the police lineup, the question of witness identification standing alone, not considering other evidence, I think looks bad enough to probably convict Oswald if you're just looking at that issue alone by a preponderance standard. We know that if it's not Oswald, it had to be someone who looked a lot like Oswald, but who likely had more of a red complexion, since Oswald did not have a ruddy or red complexion. So that's the witness ID part of it. Planning a trip this year? Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local language. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone also has lifetime memberships that give you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. And best of all, Marina Oswald used Rosetta Stone to learn English when she came to the United States. Thanks, Rosetta Stone. Okay, that part's not true, but Rosetta Stone is awesome. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Solving JFK listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start improving your language skills right away. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. The next part is the timeline. Is it possible that Oswald killed Tippit given the evidence regarding the timeline? The Warren reports and you know, the timeline here, that's where if you're a Warren report critic, that's where you hang your hat. the IDs and you point to other evidence and you point to the revolver documents if you're a Warren Report defender. If you're a critic, the whole game is the timeline. So let's talk about the timeline. The Warren Report says that Oswald left his rooming house around 1 o'clock and Officer Tippit was killed around 1:15. And it would take around 10 to 15 minutes to walk the rooming house to the Tippit murder scene. So let's look at the record to zoom in on the time. Oswald arrived around 1 o'clock using the Warren Report's timeline, or 1:03 based on what the cab driver, William Whaley, actually said. Oswald stayed no longer than 3 or 4 minutes per Earlene Roberts, who ran the rooming house. And she looked out the window and he was standing at the bus stop moments later. So the earliest that he could have left would be 1:03 per the Warren Commission's timeline, or 1:06 per William Whaley's timeline. And by the way, it was in this brief 3 or 4 minutes that the honking police car happened to drive by. Then between 1 and 1:07, so a little bit of an overlap between what I just said, Butch Burroughs at the Texas Theater says Oswald entered the theater. At 1:06, Helen Markham says Officer Tippit was shot. Now, she didn't have a watch, but she was walking on the way to catch her bus, which was a block north and was coming at 1:12. At 1:06, Margie Higgins heard shots and looked at the clock on top of her TV, and she saw that the time was 1:06. At 1:10, T.F. Bowley sees Tippett's body lying in the street, and he stops and checks his watch, and it's 1:10. Then at 1:15, Butch Burroughs sells popcorn to Oswald at the Texas Theater. So that timeline doesn't seem to leave room for if in fact the shots were fired at 1:06, as this timeline would establish, and if Oswald arrived between 1 and 1:07 and bought popcorn at 1:15, obviously he can't be shooting Tippit then. So here's where rebuttal number two comes in. Matt, you left out documents that hammer home the argument that the timing could not be as the Warren Report says. See, I thought I had covered all of them, but apparently not. There's a supplemental police report that says at 1:15, Dr. Richard LaCoury pronounced Tippit dead at the Dallas Methodist Hospital. This means that he would have had to travel a few minutes to the hospital and then arrive at the hospital and be there for at least a few minutes before 1:15 for Tippit to be pronounced dead by a doctor at 1:15. I think this is a good point. I totally missed that document. So just to reiterate the timeline, we know we got Markham's bus at 1:12. Shooting must be before 1:12. We know that. We know that T.F. Bally sees Tippit in the street at 1:10. We got Margie Higgins at 1:06 who checks her watch. You combine that with what Butch Burroughs said about Oswald arriving at the theater between 1 and 1:07 and ordering popcorn at 1:15, it does look impossible from the timeline that Oswald could have killed Tippit and been at the crime scene at that time. Adding in this 1:15 time of death at the hospital from this rebuttal provides one more point to even further demonstrate that the timeline precludes Oswald from killing Tippit. Now, the counterpoint on the Warren Report defender side here is that we have to remember time today is different from time in 1963. And the biggest difference is everyone's got phones today, digital cell phones that are locked in a pretty much synchronized time.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite and insightful points you made in that episode of the podcast, was time was not the same thing in the 1960s as it is today.
The argument is, yeah, you got the person that says 1:06, 1:10. Well, maybe their watches could have been off because we know Oswald did it, so their watches must have been off. But to me, if you're talking about a few people and you're talking about a few minutes, then I totally see a range here or there. That makes sense. I think the Margie Higgins, that clock is on top of her TV. You know what I mean? So I feel like that one would be more likely to be accurate. But you pretty much, if on the Warren Report defender side, you have to throw out time. You have to go, none of the time evidence matters. We can't rely on it because we can't trust the clocks. And I don't know that I can do that fully, but that is the timeline side of it. I got one more rebuttal, and then I want to give a conclusion on this one here. Rebuttal number three. A pedestrian named Mr. William Lawrence Smith said that he saw a man who looked just like Oswald pass him on the street on his way to eat lunch at the Town and Country Cafe near 620 East 10th Street. That's from an FBI report dated January 14th, 1964. This is several blocks east of the scene of the crime and not consistent with the path that Oswald would have had to take from his rooming house, which was northwest of the crime scene. So this is a really good point. What this person saying by sending this evidence in is that there's a report of somebody seeing someone that looked just like Oswald east of the crime scene. He's up, he's northwest. They would have, that would, you know, he would have had to backtrack to be there. He would have had to walk out of his way. There's already a question of can he even make it? So he would have had to walk out of his way to do that. You know, and there's an FBI report for this. It's not nothing. So it does make it seem like, you know, again, someone who looks like Oswald in a place where Oswald couldn't be, you know, it's a, you know, is this the same guy that keeps popping up? That's the question. So that is pretty crazy. My conclusion on whether Oswald could have killed Tippett given the timing issues is that it leans conspiracy. So, you know, unless everyone's watches and clocks were off, it's not possible that he could have killed Tippett if this timing evidence is reliable at all. So that's the challenge there. There's a lot of competing evidence. Any other thoughts on the timing part of it?
Yeah, I think 1960s time can easily be 3 to 4 minutes plus or minus the Navy clock. You know what I mean? Like, it just from, you have manual winding watches, everybody's setting that every day, even something on a countertop or a TV top at that point, you're still winding that at least once a week or something like that. So I could see time being very flexible. And even eyewitness testimony of folks on the street, Oswald's a pretty average size and looking fella. So it's pretty easy to say that someone saw Lee Harvey Oswald walking down the street. You know, there's not much difference between what I look like and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, right.
I'm a pretty average size fella.
I've suspected you for many years, actually. All right. So next question, does the ballistics evidence prove Oswald killed Tippett? We have four shells that were found at the crime scene that matched the type that were needed for a .38 special revolver, the same one that Oswald was arrested with. But those four shells don't exactly match up with the bullets from Tippett's body. There were two Winchester and two Remington shells found, but three Winchester bullets and one Remington bullet that was recovered from Tippett's body. So the shells don't exactly match the bullets. The bullets in Tippett's body were too mangled to be matched to the revolver. And according to the FBI, this was because the revolver had been rechambered, according to FBI firearms expert Cortland Cunningham. This is where rebuttal number four comes in from Frank, who is a firearms expert with a career in law enforcement and a former investigator from Texas. Frank says that the FBI firearms examiner says he couldn't match the bullets recovered from Tippett's body to Oswald's gun because it had been rechambered. This doesn't sound right at all. Revolvers do not have a chamber, as do semi-automatics. The chamber is the revolving cylinder. I did a quick internet search and learned that Oswald had a Smith & Wesson Victory model snub nose, which is a 2-inch barrel. The Victory model was made for the military, primarily with a 4-inch barrel. 500 were made with a 2-inch barrel, all of which went to the OSS, which is the predecessor to the CIA. The issue is, the Warren Report says that the gun barrel was originally 5 inches, but was shortened by George Rose and Company to 2 1/4 inch. So it sounds like from the Warren Report, the revolver that Oswald had was not originally 2 inches. It was 5 inches, and then it was shortened. So that, I believe, would rule it out from being one of the 2-inch barrels that went to the OSS. But how cool of like a dun dun dun, that'd be a cool fact if that was. But I don't believe that is the case. But
sorry, Frank, sounded awesome to me.
No, but Frank had another point. Frank actually had several points. I think Frank knows what's up. He had one other issue on this rebuttal regarding firearms. He says Winchester Western and Remington Peters are the two biggest and most common ammunition makers or they were around the early 1960s, and they were probably all that was available. So the fact that Oswald had Winchester Western and Remington Peters in his gun and some were recovered at the crime scene isn't all that compelling because basically like they were the only options. Okay, that's a fair point, but you know, he did have bullets in his pocket. It doesn't look great. It doesn't, you know. My conclusion on the ballistics is inconclusive. To me, the issue is it doesn't prove Oswald killed Tippit because the bullets from Tippit's body couldn't be matched to the bullets fired from the gun. There were three Winchester bullets and one Remington, like we just talked about, but two Winchester and two Remington shells. But on the other hand, the shells that were fired from the, you know, shells from the test firing of the revolver did match the shells at the scene. So, you know, it's inconclusive. I'll say that it leans Warren Report. I may give that one a leans Warren Report, but inconclusive. Okay. The next one is the shipping documents. So do the shipping documents for the revolver prove that Oswald ordered and received the revolver? The documents that we have establishing that Oswald ordered the revolver, we have three documents. We have CE-135, which is the mail order coupon sent to Seaport Traders, you know, the thing that he would have ripped out of the newspaper. It says it's from A.J. Hiddell to P.O. Box 2915, Dallas, Texas. January 27th is the date listed. Says that he's putting $10, sending in $10 with the, you know, the order coupon. And the FBI expert said that this matched Oswald's handwriting. The next thing we have is Heinz Michaelis Exhibit 5, which is a brief of information for COD shipment from REA Express, which directed it to pay Seaport Traders. So this is basically the document from the delivery company that says, hey, when you get paid by this guy, because the revolver was $29, so he still owed $19. So, hey, when he pays you the $19, pay it to us. That's what this document says. Okay, then the last one, Heinz Michaelis Exhibit 2, is a receipt from Seaport Traders showing that the original $10 that was sent in was received. It was $10 cash. And the remaining $19 was collected, and then you know the account was cleared and it had been paid. So the idea is that Oswald sent an order form with $10 of the $29 that was required to Seaport Trading, and then they contacted their shipping company they worked with, REA Express, who would have provided notice to the post office box that he needed to go to REA Express to pick up his package. Okay, it's kind of like UPS going to, you know, the relationship between like a UPS or a FedEx and the post office. So the idea is there would be some sort of card that would have been put in his PO box. Hey, you need to go to REA Express and pick up your shipment. And the idea is that Oswald would have received that card and then gone to the REA Express office, paid the $19, and taken the revolver. But aside from the receipt showing that $19 was paid, there's no proof on any of this part of the transaction that I was just talking about regarding Oswald actually getting the gun. Okay, they have proof around ordering the gun. Somebody ordered the gun.
There's no sign of taking it, like him bringing the card.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Yeah. No witness testimony, no documentation showing who picked the revolver up or that it was picked up at all from REA Express. We do have the receipt document, the third document, that you know shows that money was paid at REA Express, according to Seaport Traders, but we have no documentation for picking it up. Also, a certificate of good character was required when you're shipping a handgun in Texas, and we have no record of a certificate of good character existing. Now, the Warren Report counterargument to, you know, there's no documents on this part of the transaction and there's no certificate of good character which is required in Texas is basically that Railway Express just wasn't following the law. Like that's the argument. Yeah, you're right. They violated the law. And the argument is also that, you know, if you look at the rules of Railway Express, their own internal rules for, you know, what will they accept as far as ID, Oswald could have just showed the ID and they could have just said, here's a revolver, and they didn't write anything down. The problem is that's speculation. I mean, you know, we have no proof that it's a reasonable guess, but we have no proof at all about that part of the transaction. So, you know, there is some room open there. My view ultimately on the records regarding the revolver is that it's inconclusive, but the documents that we do have don't look great for Oswald, and they show that if it wasn't Oswald, he had to have been framed in a high enough level that would have also somehow included Seaport traders. I mean, that's what would appear to be the case if it wasn't Oswald. You know, and we have no proof that Oswald actually picked up the revolver or was notified of the shipment. It very well could have happened. Some people are satisfied that the order matching Oswald's handwriting combined with the document that shows the shipment was made plus the document showing there was payment is enough. And, you know, I don't think that's crazy. It's just that we don't have anything regarding who picked it up and who paid for it at REA Express and whether Oswald was actually notified by the post office. All of those documents are missing or non-existent. I do want to cover, I have a couple of rebuttals, rebuttal number 5 and 6 that are related to the revolver. Rebuttal number 5, according to Jim Mars, who's an author, conspiracy author, J. Edgar Hoover signed a report dated November 23rd, 1963, in which he stated, quote, no latent prints of any value were developed on Oswald's revolver, the cartridge cases, the unfired cartridge, or the clip in the rifle. So, and I did find this in Mars's book, but I wasn't able to find the actual citation. He didn't have a cite for this. But there were no fingerprints on the revolver. If that's true, that's something that we have not discussed that would tend to look good for Oswald, you would think. Now, although there are no fingerprints on a firearm, you know, just because there's no fingerprints on a firearm doesn't necessarily mean that someone didn't hold it. But especially in a case like this where no one's talking about him having a glove, you would think there may be some fingerprints on there. I was not able to find the document that Jim Mars cites to. I wasn't able to find this FBI report, but I also have not been able to find any document that says that there were fingerprints on the revolver. So as far as I know, there were no fingerprints on the revolver, and I think that's a good point. Rebuttal number 6, there were multiple witnesses who saw the shooter unload the shells before running off. And the question is, why did the shooter do that if they weren't about to shoot someone else? It does pose the question of why the shooter would leave the shells there, especially if they weren't going to reload. And this person says that it seems to just implicate the weapon to the crime. First of all, people say that the person who fired the shots, he cut across the corner of the Davis yard, Virginia Davis and Barbara Davis's yard, and then emptied out the revolver, emptied the shells there. Now, there's a couple of witnesses who say that he was reloading the shells there, but most of the witnesses just say that he was emptying the shells. So there's a bit of a discrepancy as to whether he was reloading. So, you know, that's really what this rebuttal comes down to. If he's just emptying the shells, then it seems like he's just laying out evidence for no reason. If he's reloading, then plausibly thought he had to fire shots again. And that's a question I really don't know the answer to, but it's a fair point. We've gone through the big ones here. We've gone through the ID, witness IDs. We've gone through timing. We've gone through ballistics. We've gone through the revolver documents. And the next thing we have is basically just all the other anomalies in the Tippit case. So, like, I'm not going to lay out every single other one. You know, like we said, go back and listen to this series of podcasts. But just to highlight a few of the little evidentiary anomalies, we got the multiple wallets that both have the Tiddell ID. We got one of them. Bob Barrett talks about the FBI agent who sees this wallet being discussed, and Captain Westbrook is reading an ID at the Tippit murder scene and asking him about Lee Oswald and asking him about Alex Hiddell. So, and we also have a video of that, of what Barrett's referencing. So we know, and we see the wallet in the video. So we know that, you know, there was a wallet there. And Barrett kind of says, well, he didn't see the ID for Oswald and Hiddell, but why would Westbrook ask him that? He's looking at the wallet. So that's wallet number one that's got the Oswald and Hiddell ID in it. But there's also a wallet that Detective Bentley and Sergeant Hill tell the Warren Commission about, where that they basically took Oswald's wallet when he was in the car after he had been arrested at the Texas Theater on the way to the police department. And the question is, how many wallets did Oswald have? That's a weird fact with this discrepancy with the wallet. So it kind of merged into one. There's not a separate police car wallet and Tippit crime scene wallet. There's just the one wallet. To me, this is just a bizarre story. I don't know what we can make of it aside from, you know, a lot of people want to point to Captain Westbrook. He keeps showing up in these places. Captain Westbrook's also getting to the next point. He's the one who finds the jacket in the parking lot. Now, to me, you know, the jacket, supposedly, you know, the person seen in a gray Eisenhower-type jacket, that's the type of jacket that's found, but it's got a dry cleaning tag on it, and Marina says that they've never done dry cleaning ever, but she also says that it belonged to Oswald. She's like, yeah, that's his, but it had a dry cleaning tag. Did you ever do dry cleaning? No, there's never any dry cleaning. It's just another one of those things that it's just kind of a question mark. Automatic versus revolver. That's another point. We have two references right after the shooting to an automatic weapon being used. Revolver is, you know, the official story. That's what's in the National Archives. That's what the serial number of the gun is. But there were these initial reports of an automatic, and initially they were looking for a fair-complected person. There's that ruddy complexion again, with a dark finish 32 automatic pistol. That was from H.W. Summers, a police radio transmission. Sergeant Hill told the dispatch at the scene that the shell at the scene indicates the suspect is armed with an automatic 38 rather than a pistol. You know, really specific, weird statements to make if they were just mistaken. It kind of almost reminds me of the whole Mauser-Carcano discussion. So, again, I don't know what to make of that. I know I've talked about a lot of stuff here. I've just zoomed through. Any thoughts on the wallets, the jacket, and the automatic versus the revolver?
Yeah, I would say that someone would have to know a lot about firearms to make that kind of a distinction, especially in some sort of like quick reaction or kind of quick scene, something happening very kinetic in the environment. So yeah. Maybe they are a weapons expert. Who knows? Maybe they're like our boy Fred over there.
Exactly. Yeah. Frank.
Frank. Yeah, our boy Frank.
Frank the Tank.
But yeah, in the multiple wallets, in him keeping one in his drawer, you know, keeping cash in there and things like that, that makes sense to me in such. So I could see him being a two-wallet man.
Right on. The next thing is Tippit's actions before the shots were fired. So this is kind of like, what was he up to right before he was killed? He tells the dispatch that he's somewhere else, but in reality, he's waiting at the Gloco gas station, which is across the street from where Oswald's bus would have potentially dropped him off. The one that he got on when he left the school book depository, that bus had a stop on the route that was directly across the street from the Gloco station. But we know that Oswald got into a cab, so he wouldn't have actually been on that bus at the time. But Tippit, then he left the Gloco station, then he placed a call at Top 10 Records on a phone that is still there today. I saw it myself. It's in a case. He placed a call there at Top 10 Records, which is very close to the Texas Theater, and then, you know, reportedly quickly left, and he looked worried or upset. Then he pulls over this guy, James Andrews, and frantically looks in the back seat before ultimately stopping to speak to the man who would kill him, the pedestrian walking on the street, who the Warren Report says was Lee Harvey Oswald. What was Tippit up to? You know, it seems like Tippit was looking for someone specific. You know, a lot of people want to say, well, he knew Oswald, or he knew he was going to be on that bus, and that's who he was looking for when he pulled James Andrews over. To me, I tried really hard not to speculate, unless I'm speculating based on hard facts, right? So I don't know what Tippit was doing. I'm just pointing out the anomalies. Let's look at rebuttal number 7. What about the stabbing at 10th and Marsalis just before Tippit was killed? This probably has something to do with Tippit being killed. What? The stabbing? I did not know anything about this, so I had a little work to do on this rebuttal. Here's what it is. Author Harrison Livingstone in The Radical Right and the Murder of John F. Kennedy noted neighborhood reports of a fight at 12th and Marsalis, but did not disclose the source of the information. According to witness Cecil Smith, there was actually a stabbing at 10th and Marsalis just before Tippett was killed at 10th and Patton. What's crazy about this stabbing at 10th and Marsalis is that aside from local anonymous neighborhood witnesses and Cecil Smith, no one is on the record confirming it. Witnesses also said that the stabbed man was put into the back of a blue Mercury Monterey. It's possible that Tippett was looking for the man who had been stabbed when he pulled over James Andrews and when he spoke to the pedestrian who would later kill him. So I would say that given that this is pure speculation based on anonymous sources, we can't really put very much weight onto it. But it is interesting that, you know, this author says that he spoke to this guy, Cecil Smith. I don't necessarily throw out evidence just because it's an author speaking to someone. I think it's possible that, you know, there are scenarios that people, you know, look at Aquila Clemens. She wasn't spoken to by anyone except for she was told to be quiet, she says. And then Mark Lane went to talk to her. So the idea here is that Tippett was trying to find the person who had done the stabbing, and that's who he was frantically looking for. There's not a whole lot of evidence. There's Cecil Smith, and there's, this Harrison Livingstone book. So I'm just throwing it out there. If you want to dig into it, I think that's worth doing. But I don't know that it changes the overall assessment, but it is one more thing to consider.
Either way, Tippett was there on an agenda.
He was doing something.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's your sense of his movements?
He wasn't there for a stroll. He had a specific agenda in which it was maybe not going as planned.
He wasn't just like on patrol, right? Because that wasn't his normal patrol area either. So, yeah, there was something going on, but maybe it'll come out as we continue to look into this case. But I don't want to speculate any further, but, you know, there's something. I do want to speculate, but I want to speculate wisely. So, all right. The next thing is this Dobbs House meeting. Dobbs House is like a breakfast diner restaurant that is about two blocks from Oswald's rooming house, okay? And there is an FBI report that talks about a waitress there, Mary Dowling, who says that Oswald normally would have coffee there between 7 and 7:30 in the morning. On Wednesday, November 20th, he was seen eating breakfast at 10 a.m. at the Dobbs House, at a time when Officer Tippett was also there, and then Tippett shot a dirty look at Oswald after Oswald cursed at the waitress for taking too long to get coffee. I covered this before in the context of, hey, here's this report of Oswald and Tippett being together at the same place. Did they know each other? Well, the report just says that Tippett shot Oswald a glance when Oswald was being rude. And that doesn't establish anything. Interesting fact, but doesn't establish anything. And then rebuttal number 8 came in. And rebuttal number 8 has affected my view of the case a little bit. I think it's we'll get to what it is. But this is one of my favorite rebuttals of the season. Rebuttal number 8. Shouldn't Oswald have been at work at the school book depository at the time he was seen at the Dobbs house with Tippett? From Randy. Well, Randy is correct. Oswald should have been at work at the time he was seen at the Dobbs house, supposedly, you know, the same time as J.D. Tippett. It says in Commission Exhibit 3001 on page 2 that Oswald's working hours were from 8 a.m. to 4:45 p.m. with a lunch period from noon to 12:45. And payroll records from the depository reflect that Oswald worked a full 8-hour day on Wednesday, November 20th. So this rebuttal, you know, I always in my mind when I thought about the Dobbs house, for some reason, I thought this meeting was on the Thursday, the day before the assassination. But it was actually on the Wednesday, which is November 20th. Now, what else happened on that Wednesday? That's the same day that Ralph Yates picks up this hitchhiker who looks like Oswald, and he's got these, you know, what he says are curtain rods, the whole Ralph Yates story. And Yates picks him up at 10:30 on the highway close to Oswald's rooming house. Well, here we have a report of someone who looks identical to Oswald, who this waitress said had been there most mornings between 7 and 7:30. And he's at this diner the same time that Tippett's there at 10 a.m., blocks away from where Ralph Yates picks up this hitchhiker at 10:30. To me, the Dobbs House sighting is no longer an interesting anomaly. It's more of a, wait a minute, this is another fake Oswald sighting. That's speculation, certainly, to some extent, but blocks away within 30 minutes. Wow, I mean, that seems crazy to me. I was excited to put that together. What do you think?
I love the double Oswald theory. It's one of my favorite kind of, I don't know if enlightenments is the right word, but kind of just one of the things that I've enjoyed through the podcast is the conspiracy of maybe there's more than one Oswald doing the stuff of what Oswald's supposed to do. Again, I always lean back to the fact that he's an average-looking guy of average height and stature and everything else, and it's pretty easy to see a guy to confuse one fella for the other on that. So as much as it makes me want to lean conspiracy, I almost lean, you know, Warren Report on it, just because of the fact that I just think he's an average-looking fella.
Right. So in other words, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an Oswald lookalike in both. Although the Yates story has specific details, but the Dobbs House one, it could just be that they, after the fact, saw this person. They go, "Hey, that guy kind of looked like Oswald," and he looked at Tippett.
I'm just saying, there's probably several hundred Dobbs houses in Dallas, Texas, in 1960s, and anyone at a bar, at a bar during the day, essentially, yeah, you know, is probably going to see some fella that ended up being Lee Harvey Oswald after the president was shot. Sure. So spin some yarn on that one.
Yeah.
I would say that the Ralph Yates story and what transpired to that fella is just, you know, just terribly tragic, and probably one of the saddest and most tragic tales that we've told on this podcast.
Yeah, for sure. And then you got the craziest thing on that one is the J. Edgar Hoover memo that says, "Give him a fourth polygraph."
Well, that fourth one is always known to, you know, really be the definitive one.
Next issue, number 4, did Oswald try to call an intelligence contact in Raleigh, North Carolina? So this is the Oswald in Jail episode 25. We know that Oswald did attempt to place a call to one of two phone numbers and one name, John Hurt, in Raleigh, North Carolina. We know exactly what was on the piece of paper that the operator wrote down because we got that piece of paper from a Freedom of Information Act request, we being, you know, the public. So John D. Hurt, he's one of the two John Hurts, he served in U.S. Army counterintelligence during World War II. So the argument from Warren Report critics is that Oswald was contacting an intelligence cutout. And that is what former assistant to the deputy director of the CIA, Victor Marchetti, believes happened here with Oswald and John Hurt. But John D. Hurt, the one who worked for military intelligence during World War II, denied knowing anything at all about any of this, which you got to admit is exactly what a CIA cutout would do. But Hurt was also disabled at the time, and he was an alcoholic. That calls into question whether he was capable of being a CIA cutout, whether, you know, the CIA would allow someone who wasn't reliable to be a cutout. So basically, after he died, John D. Hurt's wife said that Hurt had called the Dallas Police Department because he was so mad at Oswald for killing Kennedy, and that he left his number and Oswald was just calling him back. And so, you know, that would make sense. But the problem is we have this piece of paper from Oswald to the operators, and we have the paper from the Freedom of Information Act request that says that it says John Hurt, and then it has two phone numbers on it, both of which are for different people named John Hurt. So if Oswald was trying to call, you know, this guy back, then why would he have provided two phone numbers and one name? That's just the bizarre fact that doesn't make sense to me. I find it inconclusive, but I'm confused by it.
This is my 12 Monkeys moment right here. You ever see that movie with Bruce Willis? And where he's in the past and he calls a number that's supposed to be a contact, and the contact has no idea what he's talking about, but the folks from the future are monitoring the contact in the past.
Ooh.
That's what I think could be a possibility on this, is that he's contacting someone that has no idea what's going on, but then there's also possibly a third party monitoring stuff. Ooh, yeah. I love the deep, deep conspiracy on this stuff. Like, that's just as we were tracking this and recording this, that's what came to mind for me is he's Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys.
Yeah. I just don't know what the argument is of, like, how are there two phone numbers that have the same guy's name if that guy called in? Like, if you're calling someone, you like...
Oh, yes, that makes total no sense whatsoever. Like, hi, I'm here for Matt. You can call me at this number, or you can call somebody who's not me but has the same name as me at this other number.
Yes.
And I won't... Which one is it again? Oh, you'll figure it out.
Basically. Maybe he's just like an elaborate joker. He sounds like a cool guy, John D. Hurt, honestly. That one's inconclusive but interesting.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit LeafHome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
So now we're moving on to episode 26, Jack Ruby. Did the Dallas police help Ruby get in to kill Oswald? The Warren Report says that Ruby came in down the Main Street ramp when the person who was guarding it, Officer Vaughn, wasn't looking. And this is because a police car came out of the garage and Officer Vaughn, you know, went across the street and sort of stopped traffic to help this police car get out. Now, the only person who... So that's the official story, is that Ruby kind of snuck in because Officer Vaughn wasn't looking. And now the only person who says that they saw Ruby come in down the Main Street ramp, which is that's the official Warren Report story, is Officer Napoleon Daniels. But Daniels says that he stood there with Officer Vaughn and he saw Ruby come down the ramp and that Vaughn just let him in. Daniels figured that Vaughn knew him because he let him in. What Warren Report critics say is that we have multiple other witnesses who were watching the Main Street ramp from numerous angles, and they didn't see anyone come down the ramp in the relevant time frame. And then we have Patrick Dean, who was responsible for security, later admitting to the HSCA that Ruby did not come in down the Main Street ramp. My conclusion on this is that it's inconclusive, but the help of the Dallas police appears likely either way. Given, you know, either one of the scenarios, if Napoleon Daniels is right and the official story is correct, what he's saying is, no, Vaughn wasn't distracted. I stood there with him. He walked it. He watched this guy go right through. So that's the Warren Report official story. Now, the Warren Report doesn't say that about Daniels, but that's what Daniels says, and that's who Warren Report relies on. And then the other theory, you know, if Daniels is wrong, then Ruby had to get in somewhere. And that's, I think, what the weight of the evidence points to him not coming down the Main Street ramp. But, you know, the question is, how did he get in? And if it's not the Main Street ramp, he certainly would have needed the assistance of police. There are theories, but nothing's proven. Now, one rebuttal on this, one issue that was raised, shout out to Sandra, it's not a rebuttal, just sort of a point, is Napoleon Daniels talks about Ruby's hair balding, but how could he have seen Ruby's hair if Ruby was wearing a hat the whole time? I don't have an explanation for that. But anyway, so the question of how did Ruby get in down the Main Street ramp, I land on inconclusive. What are your thoughts on that, Jerry? Or did he get in down the main? How did he get in?
It's conspiracy or incompetence, right?
Right. Yeah, I think so. Aren't most things? Yeah. So that's that sounds like a campaign slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, just kidding. All right. So number six, was Ruby's idea to kill Oswald sudden and inspired by a desire to, you know, save Jackie Kennedy from a trial? Or was it premeditated and for some other reason? That's the big question with Jack Ruby. Warren Report defenders argue that Ruby suddenly killed Oswald and did not plan it because Ruby had just sent this money transfer at the nearby Western Union only minutes before he killed Oswald, and Ruby had his dog in his car. That doesn't sound like the actions of someone who it was really important for them to kill Oswald. Doesn't sound like what they would do. But Warren Report critics point to Ruby trying to get in to see Oswald on the third floor of the police department. They point to Ruby posing as a journalist, Ruby being seen by these three live broadcast technicians earlier on Sunday morning when he said that he was home. They point to the testimony of Karen and Bruce Carlin about Ruby pre-planning the Western Union transfer and Ruby's reported demeanor after killing Oswald. You know, supposedly he was relieved after he found out that Oswald had died. But the strongest argument that Ruby's idea to kill Oswald was premeditated and was to silence Oswald, to me, it's from the psych notes of Warner Tudor, the story of Al Maddox, that his Ruby's prison guard, that Ruby confessed to being part of a conspiracy, and Ruby's on-camera statement that powerful people put him in the position that he's in. I mean, the on-camera statement, that's really the big one there. So to me, my conclusion is that it leans conspiracy, and it looks like Ruby killed Oswald to silence him. I have one last rebuttal number nine, and this is a doozy. It's from Adam in Australia. What about the calls Ruby made to a Hoffa-connected guy and the huge increase in long-distance calls placed by Ruby before the assassination? What about the CIA doctor, Jolyon West, who visited Ruby immediately before his Warren Commission testimony? What about Ruby's trips to Cuba in 1959 and his connections to Santos Traficante? What about Ruby's time in Chicago in the 30s running errands for Al Capone? What about Dorothy Kilgallen, the only journalist to spend time with Ruby in jail, who was then found dead? We have a related comment from Rasmus in Denmark. What about Jolly West and Ruby being injected with cancer cells? So, yes, those are all issues that I think deserve a deeper dive. And honestly, they're beyond the scope of season one. Those sort of get into a whole other level of depth. And I think that we need to keep this podcast rolling to address those issues. So I don't have answers for those. I'm not going to address those or digest those right now. But I will commit to covering them in the future. Your thoughts when it comes to Ruby's motive?
Thing I always go back to is he left his dog in the car. And you got to be a cold-hearted bastard to just give up on your dog. That's what I can't resolve at the end of the day. I really can't. It's just an odd behavior for somebody who knows he's going into a suicide mission.
Right.
Inevitably, even though they're not, may not take his life, you're going into a police station, you're going to shoot a man, that's your plan, and you leave your dog in the car.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in that fact plus the Western Union, it's like, why would you place a Western Union transfer right before? And then it turns out that whole thing was like set up and the night before with the dancer that worked with him. And then it's almost, you know, the thing about the dog in the car, it's either, it either is what it sounds like it is, And it's like, no, he just did it spur of the moment. Who leaves a dog in the car? Or he's truly thought through this and goes, no one's going to think if I leave the dog in the car, they're never going to be able to say I did it. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Or maybe he knows the dog will be fine left in the car. It'll be turned over to somebody.
Dog.
Maybe it's somebody from the police station.
It's the fall in Dallas. We're good.
If he is well known by the cops, maybe he knows pup will be in good hands with
right.
the cops.
The cops will take care of it for him.
Yeah. Who knows?
That makes sense.
But if you're a cold-blooded killer, you're going to leave your dog in the car. That seems odd.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, that's where, you know, we kind of land on the conclusions for this episode. Lots of good recap and rebuttals. Rebuttal number 9, that kind of hammers it home. We've got more work to do. We will be having a season 2, so that is exciting, and certainly looking forward to that. We'll talk more about that in the next episode. We'll be out August 8th. Will be the final produced episode, episode 27, Conclusions. And we'll basically just go through every single issue. It'll be sort of like a produced version of a recap and rebuttals. We'll summarize and then talk about where we're going next. So that's the plan. Definitely appreciate everybody who's been with us this season. The numbers in terms of people listening to the podcast keeps going up, and it's been a wonderful experience, so truly do appreciate it. If you have time and you wouldn't mind if you could give us a 5-star review and a quick little note, that really helps us to get in the charts and be visible. We've been in the top 200 history podcast charts for the last 6 weeks or so, so that helps, you know, more people to discover it. So appreciate everybody who's listened and told friends, and again, I feel very honored to be, you know, putting all this information together and going on this journey that I know many of you have been on for much longer than me. And again, just appreciate the opportunity. So, Jerry, any sort of parting thoughts here?
Just thanks to everybody out there for going on this journey with us. And look forward to showing everybody season 2.
Amen. All right. And you can catch Jerry DePizzo and OAR out on the road in North America. Are you guys just in the United States for this leg?
I think we're stateside. Yeah, just stateside for this summer tour.
Pretty much all the cities in the United States with the Goo Goo Dolls starting...
24th.
July 24th. All right. Cool. All right. Well, we'll see you guys for episode 27, Conclusions, very soon.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. LeafHome.com/water.